begin. We're going to be beginning with Rav Eliel ben Amozig. I don't have time to go back and do everything we did last class. The class is available online for those who want to see it or listen to it. Here he is, Rav Elijah ben Amozig. So I will begin with him. Just let me begin by saying, clarifying something. I think in the last class I mentioned he was speaking about the notion of Kiddush Hashem, of dying for God's name as it applies to non-Jews. And I think I might have said that they are not permitted. He didn't think non-Jews were permitted to do this. That would not be correct. He didn't think there was an obligation. But as I mentioned, he thought that we are actually supposed to venerate those non-Jews, Christians, who were killed by the Inquisition or heresy-hunting organs of the church, because they held to a pure idea of God. We ended last semester, and it was many months ago, but we ended by asking this question. Since Ben Amozig has explained how the role of non-Jewish religion, and how he thinks it's quite significant, then the question is, well then, what's the role of the Jewish people vis-a-vis the world at large? If non-Jews can also attain to all the things the Jews can attain to, or basically all the things in terms of following God's words and theological truth, he responds as follows, that the Jewish people function as the priests to the world. What is a priest? I mean, the Torah refers to them this way. It's a little strange, because what's a priest? We know that a priest is one who's a go-between, who goes between the people and God. So what sense is it to refer to the Jewish people as a whole as a priestly people? Such that, and just like in other religions, the priests act as the go-between, so too the Jewish people as a whole will act as priests to the world. That is, they bring the message of monotheism and Jewish values to the world. So that's what it means when the Bible says that the people of Israel as a whole are a kingdom of priests. They serve as priests to the entire world. In fact, we are actually better able to serve as priests today than in years past, because he goes so far as to say in the book Tom Lashad, which we'll speak about, for some reason I have to, every time I want to open up a picture, I have to let go of the sound, but you're not losing the sound, I have to let go of it for a second. Tom Lashad is a book we'll speak about next class. It's his defense of Kabbalah against the Shadal, against Samuel David Lasato. And in this book, which I have a copy of it, because you can go to HebrewBooks.org, and for about $6, you can get yourself a copy of it printed, no problem. In this book, on page 147, he writes that just as there is material progress in modern civilization, this is paralleled by the spread of Kabbalah among the Jews, which is theological progress and things like that. The truth is that mainstream Kabbalah, at least branches of mainstream Kabbalah, forget about Berg and the Kabbalah Center, believe that subsequent to the Ari, subsequent to Rav Isaac Oria, Kabbalah is not supposed to remain the province of a small elite. On the contrary, it's supposed to be spread widely. And obviously, Hasidic thought believes in spreading it. Ben Amozig is also of this perception that Kabbalah is supposed to be spread. And not just among Jews, as we'll see. The Mekubalim thought, the Kabbalist thought, that as time goes on and we become closer to the Messianic era, more and more secrets are revealed. And when we reach the Messianic era, even non-Jews will be led into these secrets. Why? Because the Messianic era is a time when non-Jews will be taught the truths of Judaism, the truths of the world, theological truths. And you can't teach them this without Kabbalah. Now, Ben Amozig will speak, when he speaks about Kabbalah, and last time we dealt with how significant he sees Kabbalah, he speaks in a way that leads to paradoxes. For example, he notes that there are two different levels in Judaism. really two different religions. The Rambam spoke like this. There's the religion of the masses and the religion of the thinkers. And Ben Amozig says the same thing. There's a religion of the masses and a religion of the thinkers. But for him, the religion of the thinkers is the Kabbalistic religion. Let me give you an example of what he means. For the masses, Judaism is presented as completely monotheistic, with perfect unity. That's what you're taught in school. Everyone knows that. Judaism is monotheistic. One God indivisible. Maimonides, God. But Amozig sees this as the religion of the masses. He obviously rejects the Rambam's philosophy. But when he says it's the religion of the masses, he says this is the religion of the masses from day one, from Talmudic times to the present, even before Talmudic times. Yet there's a more profound Judaism. But this is only for the elites. And this Judaism knows of a plurality in a way that the average person can't understand. What do I mean by that? Let me explain for a second at one point. Most people, when they learn a bit about Kabbalah, they're shocked. Why are they shocked? Because their entire life was based on the notion of monotheism, a Maimonidean type of monotheism. A simple God, if you look in the, you don't have to look in the guide, you look in the Mishnah Torah. God cannot be divided. In the guide, you can't even speak about God in a positive way. Because anything you say about him, it's like you're giving an attribute to him. With Kabbalah, everything is complicated. I mean, if you know a bit about Kabbalah, you know about the Sefirot, how we affect God and what we do. Everything is complicated. And Amozig notes that in the Holy of Holies, Kodesh Kodashim, in the temple, there were two cherubs on top of the ark. Now, we know that images are completely forbidden. None of our synagogues have images. And yet, there they were to be found, not just in the temple, but in one special place, the Holy of Holies, where the high priest goes once a year. So we can therefore see some of the paradox, Ben Amozig says, that Judaism, at the same time that it teaches as a commandment, no images, and we're taught that we cannot venerate images, can't think about images, anything like that. Yet in the Holy of Holies, a special place was carved out precisely for an image. See this paradox. You have no images, complete monotheism, together with images. And then Amozig explains that there is a simple description of God and a simple practice of Judaism that leads to more complicated, both with the image I mentioned, but also the more complex descriptions of the Kabbalah. And he points to this distinction between paganism and Judaism. What is paganism? And I think in paganism he would include Hinduism in this. So let's speak about Hinduism. Hinduism speaks of unity, but only at the depths of the religion. Anyone who knows anything about Hinduism knows that there's loads and loads of gods. Yet if you also know about Hinduism, you know that Hindus believe that fundamentally, it's all one. That the public face of the religion of the people, is mythological, with all the gods. However, the religion for the thinkers is fundamentally monotheist. And any Hindu thinker will tell you that these gods are just manifestations of the one God, but there is only one God. Ben Amozig says that Judaism is similar to this. He's going to explain what the difference is between paganism and Judaism is, and also the great mistake of paganism. But in this point, he says, Judaism is similar to paganism. Judaism, but it's the reverse. Paganism, publicly, for the masses, is mythological with many gods. But privately, for the elites, it's one God. It's monotheistic. Judaism is just the reverse. For the masses, publicly, and in its public face, it's the strongest advocate of monotheism and unity of God. Yet in its more esoteric side, Kabbalistic side, Ben Amozig says, this monotheism becomes a monotheism of plurality. Plurality within unity. Sefirot are plurality. There's no getting around that. And yet it's plurality within a unity. It is monotheism. But it's not monotheism the way people think of it usually. It's monotheism, which is a plural form of monotheism. And I've said it before, that based upon the Kabbalah, there is no, in my opinion, and no one has yet shown me that I'm wrong, there is no theological objection to the Trinity. From a Maimonidean standpoint, 100%. But from a Kabbalistic standpoint, there is no theological objection to the Trinity. The objection is to the incarnation. The idea that God assumes form in a human body. That's the notion. The idea that God becomes human, or that you worship a human being. But the idea of a Trinity, that God is seen in three parts which are one, if you read the Kabbalistic descriptions in Ben HaMozig and just in classic Kabbalah, you can justify the Trinity the exact same way. In fact, they use the same metaphor of a fire. That a fire, on fire, but it has different colors, or that the fire can spread up and down, and yet it's still one fire. That the Christians use the same imagery, and it's no accident, therefore, that the opponents of Kabbalah, such as, and not just the opponents of Kabbalah, you see this in the response of Reb Ash, but also Abraham Abulafia, the leading Kabbalist, says, what the Christians call three, the Kabbalists call ten. Just the question, is it divided into three or divided into ten? And Ben HaMozig explains that this is the religion of Kabbalah. It's not the religion of the Manasses, and you're not supposed to be exposed to it, although as time goes on, as we come closer to the Messianic era, and more Kabbalistic mysteries are revealed, the masses will learn more about this. Ben HaMozig says that the more abstract an idea is, the more it must be described in simple language. So the idea of the Godhead, that God is complicated, although yet he's simple, this is not something the masses can understand. So we have to describe it in simple terms. Hashem Echad. But from the standpoint of Kabbalah, Echad is not what we think of when we think of one. It's a complex oneness, complex unity. There's an entire Godhead. So therefore, but this is not something the masses can understand, so everything described in the Bible is simple. Now, Ben HaMozig goes further. He sees Kabbalah as not just a wisdom of the Jews, but an ancient wisdom that inspired numerous myths in the ancient world, and these myths were distorted, of course, over time, but yet they are the patriarchs, to ancient man, Bible, and other ancient texts. It doesn't detract from the originality of the Torah. Most people would look at these things. Most people look at these stories and see borrowings. And then HaMozig does see borrowings, but not from the Torah, the Torah borrowing from others. He sees these as ancient ideas which go back very far in time that survive in the ancient world, as well as in Judaism. This was a common idea from the philosophical standpoint also, although the Rambam doesn't say this. The Rambam says that philosophy is true. To have philosophy, we lost it, and therefore we go to Aristotle to take back what we used to have, but not that Aristotle took it from us. But other medievals, Levi and others, believe in this notion that the ancient Greeks, they learned their philosophy from the Jews. Jeremiah was thought to be friendly with Aristotle and things like that, and therefore when we study philosophy, we're actually taking back what they took from us. He says the same thing about Kabbalah. And he gives amazing examples of this. He explains the strange way the Talmud describes how you count when you sprinkle the altar. We know this from the High Holy Day liturgy. We don't say 1, 2, 3, 4. We say 1, 1 and 1, 1 and 2. Where does that come from? Chazal, the rabbis, I mean, you have explanations offered, but they don't really know, Ben HaMozig thinks. And Ben HaMozig is an expert in ancient cultures and ancient religions. We'll get back to this. And it turns out, lo and behold, that's the way that in ancient Egypt they used to count, or so Ben HaMozig tells us. So in ancient Egypt, when they wanted to say three, they didn't say three, they said 1 and 2. And 4, they said 1 and 3. Now Chazal no longer knew why this was counted this way, or that is why this was the way they counted, the priests, high priests, and everyone else. But they preserved the ancient way faithfully. And the reason for this way of counting goes back to ancient times, to the culture that the Jews were a part of. So the fact that we have this ancient way of counting, we don't know why, we see the Egyptians doing the same thing. That's the greatest proof that the sages preserved something in its purity, even though at, by the time you get to Chazal, they don't even, weren't even aware of why you did it this way. The proof that this is the ancient Jewish way of doing things is precisely because we see the Egyptians were doing it. Ben Amozig assumes that the Jews didn't take this from the Egyptians, that this was basic to Judaism. So we thus see the value of knowing ancient cultures. That ancient Jewish culture was diffused in the Near East. And we're going to see some more examples of this. This is why it's so valuable. We can understand Torah texts by seeing the ancient world. There are other examples in the Torah. We see elements of these cultures, and Kabbalah is the key where they want to illuminate biblical stories by ancient Near Eastern literature, languages, Ugaritic, Akkadian, and the like. And even in the Orthodox world, you have some of this. Barry Eicher, now of Yeshiva University, has an article in one of the Orthodox Forum volumes, how the ancient world, ancient Near East in particular, illuminates biblical texts. But Ben Amozig is doing this. He's doing it really in a pre-critical era, and he's looking at Kabbalah. In his teaching and writing, Ben Amozig thinks that it's vital that Jews not keep apart from modern intellectual trends. Because as he says, Jewish Livorno, that's where he is, City of Livorno. Let me show you on the map again. You see Livorno there on the left, right below Pisa? Hopefully, if our summer trip is successful, there'll be more trips. Torah in Motion will go on motion again. Hopefully, we can take a trip to Italy. Obviously, Pisa and Livorno and Florence, Ancona, that's on the east, Rome. There's other places are important stops on the Jewish story in Italy. Venice, all these cities, Turin, Torino, but you see Livorno there, right below Pisa, on the left side, above Elba and Corsica. He says, quote, Jewish Livorno can remain Orthodox only by becoming scientific. What that means is that we can remain Orthodox only if we become educated. Italy, by the 19th century, was a very intellectually open place. And the only way for, there was no longer a ghetto, the only way to keep Jewish tradition alive was by showing that you can have a combination of Judaism and Western culture. Same thing that Samson Raphael Hirsch and Israel Hildesheimer realized in Germany. He writes a commentary, Aim La Mikra. Here is the title page, the commentary on the book of Genesis. Five volumes. And you can see his efforts in this regard in trying to enlighten the Jewish people in Italy. In trying to bring to bear his knowledge of the ancient world, so sorts of languages. One of these volumes was just published by put online by HebrewBooks.org, but you can see all the volumes on Google Books. So I know four of the volumes actually on Google Books. But the one on Hebrew Books, you can get it printed even. And he combines all of this with his Kabbalistic ideas. You'd be surprised that this work was condemned? It was condemned, and it was condemned by the rabbis of Aleppo, Syria. There has been the trend of extremism in Aleppo for a long time. Sometimes these screens have a mind of their own. So that's why we have Shalom, and he'll get my picture up. There's a young man in the Syrian community. He published a couple years ago Isaac Reggio's commentary. He's an Italian scholar, a bit of a maschio on the Torah. Very interesting commentary. He wants to publish this very much, the Amal Mikra, because it's quoted. Ben Amozig is quoted by numerous Sephardic thinkers, or by Meir Mazuz, the great Rabbi Meir Mazuz of Kisei Rachamim Meshiv and B'nai Brak quotes Ben Amozig. Others do it. Rakov Chaim Sofer in Jerusalem. But he's afraid to print the book because the Aleppo community, the Syrian community, is basically an Aleppo community. They condemned this book, and they burnt this book. and I'll tell the story now, and he's afraid if he does it, it's going to create all sorts of controversies. What do they find problematic? The electoral community find problematic in Rabbi Ben Amozig's Ein LaMikra. First, he quotes, if you remember the Hertz Pentateuch, he's quoting non-Jewish scholars, non-Jewish literature, Christian texts, ancient Egyptian texts, all in order to illuminate the Torah. And as I said, there's always been a trend of extremism in Aleppo. Think of the Sephardic world often as more open-minded, and we're going to see that with the next thinker we deal with, Rabbi Joseph Massas. Certainly that was the case in Morocco and Turkey, but you had extremism, and you had it in Aleppo. When this Chumash, the Ein LaMikra, came to Syria and they saw what he was quoting, they couldn't take it. The idea that he was citing ancient Egyptian texts and Christian texts together with Kabbalah and other Torah sources was blasphemous for them. Let's not forget that these rabbis in Aleppo opposed secular studies in their entirety. They're very unusual for the Sephardic world. The Sephardic world usually was very open to secular studies, and there were rabbis in Syria who were, but not in Aleppo. I don't know, I see on my screen, there's, I don't know if you see this, if you tell them we'll take care of it, all of a sudden I see some weird things on my screen. Huh? Okay, it's gone. Second, they opposed his statements throughout his work, which is, what did he say? Let me go back for a second. The whole work, Ein LaMikra, is designed to show that various beliefs and practices in the Bible have parallels in ancient times. And that's the point of that, is to illuminate the Psukim in the Torah. They opposed this completely. They went so far, the latter part of the 19th century, to burn his book. They saw it as real heresy. Not only that, they turned to other rabbis. They began a letter-writing campaign, because Ben Amozig was not an insignificant figure. He would often publish in the Halavanon, which was the Hebrew periodical that all the rabbis read. He was well known as the leading rabbi in Italy. So, but they saw him as preaching heresy. They turned to the rabbis of Damascus. And the rabbis of Damascus went along and burnt the book also. Yet the great Rav Chaim Palachi, who we have a series on, of the chief rabbi of Turkey. He was in Izmir, actually, but he was the chief rabbi, not just of Turkey, of the Ottoman Empire. Great post-Sephardic, one of the most important Sephardic figures in the 19th century. He stood up for Ben Amozig and writes him this beautiful letter of encouragement that is published. So Ben Amozig has on his side the great Rav Chaim Palachi. The Jerusalem rabbis, Aleppo wrote to the Jerusalem rabbis asking them to burn the book and to ban it, and they refused to do so. They wanted to remain neutral, though. They did not publicly support Ben Amozig, but they told the rabbis in Aleppo they're not going to get involved. And so it was the rabbis of Aleppo versus Rav Chaim Palachi and Ben Amozig. And Ben Amozig wrote a whole essay in response to these rabbis, and he, for the life of him, could not understand what these rabbis are on about. Ben Amozig is from a completely different world. The notion that there was something wrong with secular studies, and especially if these could be used to prove the truth of Torah, was not something that an Italian rabbi could understand. You can see his response. It was actually reprinted in the book I have here. I'll show you this book. Masoret B'Idan HaModerni, Masoret in the Modern Times. It focuses on these Sephardic rabbis, Ben Amozig, the Ben Ishai, Rav Uziel, and some others. And it reprints that long essay. It took out a few sections of it because it's quite a long essay of Ben Amozig in response to the rabbis of Aleppo. And like I said, he can't figure out for the life of him. Here he's trying to prove the truth of Torah and illuminate verses by citing texts which every Italian Jew knows. And if you grew up in Italy, you knew Dante, you knew the ancient, you knew Ovid, these were classic texts. It's like if you grew up in America, you know basic. We have basic cultural things. We know television shows and things like that. If you grow up in Italy, you know the great Latin orators. You know, if you're educated, you know the Greek writers also. And here you have rabbis saying that there's something wrong with this. He can't understand it. any response to them. That in today's day and age, it's vital to know secular studies and to use them in defending and expounding upon the Torah. Can you imagine if the Jews of Italy and Western Europe as a whole, if they're told that they can't have any secular learning? This is what Hirsch was confronted with. No one's going to remain in the Orthodox community if that's the way you have to live. That's not a realistic. That doesn't express what Judaism is for Italy, especially Italy. Italy was always a very cultured place. Always been a sense since the Renaissance and even before of enlightened rabbis. We think of the Ramchal, for example, and Silas Yesharim and the other things he wrote. Ramchal, any book on history of Hebrew literature will speak about Ramchal. He wrote plays. He wrote poetry. He was learned in secular matters. He didn't have a beard either. So that was another thing in Italy. Then Amozig writes how Torah and secular studies cannot be kept as two separate spheres because this will create religious doubt. If you tell people that you just have to focus on Torah, you can't study secular matters, people are going to assume then, if they're convinced that the secular matters have truth in them, that the secular philosophers and scientists have truth, and since the rabbi said you can't study them, well, it must mean, therefore, that Torah is false. Because the rabbi said that the two cannot coexist. And Amozig explains that this is not just dangerous, this is not the Jewish way of doing things. You need to synthesize the best of modern culture and wisdom to Torah. He is respectful in his reply. I have to say that, although he has some biting comments, for the most part he's respectful. And he states that he's correct, that the rabbis in the Middle East do not know the dangers facing the Jews of Europe. And this notion that the Jews can just live in Italy, cultured, intellectually and materially advanced place, like they're living in the Mela in Egypt, you know, the ghetto in Egypt or in Syria. It was the Syrian rabbis who wrote it, but the Mela actually is a Moroccan term, but like in the ghetto of Syria, he says that this would be a disaster for the Jews, since educated Jews simply reject advanced European, would simply reject Torah when they were exposed to advanced European. Today, he says it's especially dangerous today because we all know that light blinds people who have been in darkness for a long time. If you come out, you've been in a cave for a year, and you come out, the light blinds you. You have to get used to it. It takes you a while. You have to be exposed to it gradually. So he says that if you would secular studies when it reach and philosophy, when it reaches areas where the people have not been exposed to it at all under the auspices of tradition, immediately they're exposed to it, and it's as if they're coming out of a cave. They can't handle it. It leads them to reject tradition. And that happened. And of course that happened. That's what happened in Eastern Europe, where within the space of a generation, so many people rejected religion. Had they been introduced to secular learning as they were in Germany, Germany had, once Hirsch's system got on the way, very little attrition. These systems, Ben Amozig says, of where you're isolated from the outside world only works when you're isolated. But we're in a world today where you can't be isolated, and therefore you need to train people so that they recognize what the outside world has to offer, the good and the bad. He points to the Jews of Algeria. Once the French moved into Algeria, very quickly Algeria, basically religious society, collapsed. We don't need to look at Algeria in the 19th century. Look what happened to the Sephardic populations when they came to Israel. These were people, and yet take the Yemenites. Every single Yemenite in 1948 was Sabbath observant. You did not have, I dare say, that in the entire 1,000 years that Jews lived in Yemen, you did not have 5 Yemenite murderers. In 1,000 years, I would assume. You might have had one or two. And every single year today in the state of Israel, you'll have 5 Yemenite murderers. I mean, what happened was, Ben Amozig would say, just like happened in Algeria. You took people who had no exposure at all and immediately threw them into the modern world, and they couldn't deal with it. And Ben Amozig says that, with regard to Algeria, what happened there, that the rabbis have to take the blame. Because when the French schools opened up and the parents started sending their kids to the French schools, they found no reason not to reject tradition. The rabbis were so busy opposing anything modern, that they laid the groundwork for this rejection by the masses. And he says that the rabbis who oppose him have to share in the blame for the situation that's going to develop. Israel Hildesheimer said the exact same thing to the rabbis of Hungary. Samson Raphael Hirsch thought the same exact thing. All these Torah Derech Eretz figures assume that it's these closed-minded rabbis, the obscurantist rabbis, who are going to be the unsay they're right. He makes a number of other significant points in his reply to these rabbis in Aleppo. Let me just mention some of them. He begins by saying, by recounting the four supposed problems that they found in his commentary. Let me read you, or summarize for you what they are that the rabbis of Aleppo found. One I mentioned, he mixed Kodesh and Chol, Torah and secular, by citing secular studies. Also, he didn't just cite them, it would be bad enough to cite ancient texts, he used them to illuminate the words of the prophets. Point number two. Number three is, he said that the ancient nations knew Jewish ideas. Not sure why they objected to that, but that's they objected to that. And fourth, and this is the worst, he said that Ben Amozig assumed that they not just knew Jewish ideas, they knew Kabbalistic ideas. Rabbis from Aleppo said this is outrageous. Kabbalah is a secret Jewish teaching. You're going to say that non-Jews have some knowledge of our secret teaching? Impossible. That's what he says the problems were. He begins his answer by saying that one cannot understand the essence of the Torah without knowing the Chachmot, without knowing wisdom. The Vilna Gaon said the same thing. He's quoted by a student, Baruch of Shklov, saying that to the extent that you're deficient in the sciences, he wasn't referring to philosophy, but the sciences, all the sciences, you are even more so deficient in Torah learning. Ben Amozig is speaking about all matters, all secular studies. He gives an example. The Torah says, we read it a few weeks ago, that at the creation, there was tohu vavohu. Whatever that means. Nothingness, unformed, void. Well, how do you understand what tohu vavohu is? Without knowing about science. Without knowing about nature. And he says, once again correctly, this is how the great commentaries approached it. If you look at the medieval commentaries, when they're trying to understand what tohu vavohu is, what the rakia is, the firmament, they use the science of their times. So we don't have to accept that science. We use the science of our times, basic, but the point is the same. That to illuminate these verses, you need to use the sciences. The Torah describes the Israelites in Egypt. So Ben Amozig says, how can you understand this story without knowing something about Egyptian language and practices? You're lacking. You're missing out on basic elements of the story that can be illuminated by ancient Egyptian languages. And he says that not only are is what I just said, the problems of the Aleppo rabbis, they're not even traditional, he says. Because the sages, our great sages, if you open up the Talmud, you see that they were learned in all the fields of wisdom. And they used them when they needed to. If the sages of the Talmud could do this, if the medievals could do this, how is it that we can't do this? So he doesn't understand the objection. He mentions that there are Jewish traditions recorded in Sfarim, and not modern Sfarim, but the classical Sfarim, canonical Sfarim, that Socrates studied with Jewish teachers, and Plato studied with Jewish teachers. Now, there's no question that Ben Amozig knew this was false. They're legends, but that's not the point. The point is that these are recorded in canonical Jewish texts and are thought to be positive things, and are recorded and thought to be that this is natural, that the Jewish sages would have wisdom, so therefore, of course, the non-Jewish learned people would come to study with them. So obviously, you're going to have, in non-Jewish writings, echoes of Jewish wisdom. So how can the rabbis of Aleppo come and say, no, it's impossible to think that there would be any Jewish wisdom in the writings of the Gentiles? He says it is ironic, more like crazy. He says, it's like a joke that the Aleppo sages are such fans of Ibn Ezra. Here they're attacking Ben Amozig and they love Ibn Ezra in 19th century Aleppo. And Ibn Ezra, he says, teaches that there are post-Mosaic verses in the Torah. And Ibn Ezra is the real radical and they love Ibn Ezra, and me, Ben Amozig, I'm a traditionalist, a conservative with a small c. I reject Ibn Ezra on this and all these other. Not only that, he says, I reject the Rambam's view of sacrifices. He has a whole list of things he's traditional in, and they're attacking me? He says it's like a joke. He goes further. For those who don't know about what I mentioned of Ibn Ezra advocating post-Mosaic verses in the Torah, you can take a look at my book, Limits of Orthodox Theology, Chapter 7. And I give all the details. Yes, he is similar to Joseph Soloveitchik. When he came to Halacha, was so conservative with a small c. And yet they attacked him, but Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, I've mentioned this before, he was really liberal. And they didn't attack him. So there is an irony here. He goes further. He gives... Okay, so he talks about, if you have this book, Masoret Bidon HaModerni, this is 36 and 37, how we can learn about Jewish practices by looking at the ancient world. And then he says, what does it mean, you can't follow in the Chukim, you can't follow in their practices? It means that that's their foolish practices and their idolatrous practices. But if there's good practices, we can learn from them. And therefore, if there are things in Torah that appear similar to the ancient practice of the ancient world, rather than reject them, on the contrary, let's assume, he says, that they got it from us, and therefore we can learn about Torah. It says explicitly here, Devarim, Yesha Torah, Devarim Domim Umin Hage Kadmone Helmot, that there are aspects of the Torah that find parallels. The truth is that you don't need to defend this. Anyone who says that there aren't parallels is just famous. We have facts. There are practices in the ancient world that are similar to what we have in the Torah. So that's indisputable. The question is, what do you do with those practices? How do you explain those practices? You could say the Torah borrowed them. Or you can say, as Ben Amozig says, that these are part of the ancient Jewish wisdom, which is then codified in the Torah of Moses, but these existed among the patriarchs. Remember what Chazal say, that the patriarchs did certain practices even before they were commanded, and these then became part of the ancient world. We see with Noah, he says, that Noah is told to take the clean animals. That shows you, according to Ben Amozig, that already in the days of Noah, you had a concept of kosherness of a sort. A distinction between kosher and non-kosher. So, therefore, if you find the ancient world, they also have a type of kosherness, it's to be expected. Malki Tzedek is mentioned in the Bible, king of Shalem, and a priest of God. Now, Shalem is traditionally thought to be Jerusalem. What does this show you? This shows you that there is already an ancient tradition long before Jews entered the land of Israel about the holiness of Jerusalem, which even the non-Jews knew about. He asks, is it possible that Abraham, who was obviously famous in his day, trying to convert people, that the details of his faith would not become known? That people wouldn't have tried to imitate him? That's why there are similarities in the Torah's description of ritual and other ancient cultures. And he continues to defend this position, and he cites Chazal, and he cites examples of biblical texts, both in stories and law, especially in laws, which you have parallels in the ancient world. Now, I mentioned before that one of the things his opponents were most upset about was his belief that the ancient non-Jews, not only that they knew about practices, even with Judaism, but they knew Kabbalah, or better, had Kabbalistic knowledge. In the Zohar, Ben Amozig says, he points out that if you look in the Zohar, in volume 2 of the Zohar, page 237a, it refers to Yavan is Greece, as, quote, close to the faithful path. That is, Greece is close. They're not perfect, but they're on the right path. What does that mean? And Amozig says this refers to Greek philosophy, in particular Plato. That the Zohar itself recognizes that there's truth, Kabbalistic-like truth, because that's how Ben Amozig understands this philosophy, as having Kabbalistic-like orientation in Greek philosophy. In fact, I found that the great Mkubo, Menachem Rekanati, in his commentary to Parshas Lukas, you can see this on HebrewBooks.org also, says that the Zohar is referring to Aristotle, who agrees with the rabbis in certain things. So Obviously, we see from this that the ancients had correct knowledge. So some of which, at least, he identifies with Kabbalistic knowledge. And those are very conservative in some respects. For example, he wants to show that science does not dispute what Chazal says. He doesn't want to interpret Agadot allegorically. When Chazal say there are previous worlds created and destroyed, for him, this is to be taken literally. And it fits in with modern science that the earth went through many upheavals. And it goes on and on. I don't have time to go into any more detail. Let me just say that there is an article by a man named, an Israeli scholar, Yaron Harel. He just came out with a book published by Lippmann Library on the Jews of Syria. But he has a separate article devoted to the burning of the Emunah Mikra. Why was it that this, you know, there's so many books out there? If you want to start burning books, there's other books you can burn. And well, why now? Why in 1860? Get the exact year, 1868 maybe. He wants to know why, you know, what led up to it. And he makes a connection between this, that is the burning of Ben Amos' Emunah Mikra, and the traumatic events that occurred in Aleppo in 1862 when a reform community was established by Rabbi Rafael Katzin in Aleppo. A reform community was established in the heart of Sephardic society. Let me clarify by saying that the Aleppo rabbis regarded this as a reform community. Not a reform when you think of Germany or anything like that. It was really a Haskalah type of community. Katzin had been influenced by Haskalah type of literature. He was not telling people that they don't need to observe Shabbos or Kashrus or anything like that. It was simply that he wanted a more open-minded approach, secular education. When we go to Prague, we'll deal with the Nota Yehuda and his son, Elazar Fakulas, the Chuvamay Yava, and then we will deal with what happened afterwards. Rabbi Yehuda's grandson was a big maskil, religious maskil, and an ally of a rabbi named Shir, Shlomo Yehuda Rapport. We'll go to his grave, we'll talk about him. Plug him in online, you can see pictures of him with a nice long beard, looks like a typical Hasidish Rebbe. But he was elected rabbi in Prague in the mid-19th century, and you could say that he was like a modern Orthodox rabbi, an open-minded rabbi. And Rabbi Yehuda's grandson was a supporter. So we're not dealing with a reform rabbi. He was based in, but he had modern ideas. And the same thing with Katzin. And just like Shir was attacked by the Hasidim and by others, so too this Rafal Katzin, who would have fit in very well in Germany or America or England, he was attacked. So Harel develops the thought that the community was already split. And which looks very much like a Haskalah type of work with secular literature, etc. So therefore, the rabbis were looking to respond. They were on edge. And had it not been for this reform-style community, they would not have been so sensitive to a commentary like Ben Amozig. Another significant work of Ben Amozig is, as I mentioned, Tom Lashkod. I don't want to go into in detail now about what Shadal said. We will have classes on Shadal, the great Shmuel David Gatzato of Padua, who in many ways is such an important and great scholar, a pious man, and yet he's also a critical scholar, and one of his areas of criticism was the Rambam, a great opponent of the Rambam. He thought that the Rambam really had destroyed Judaism by bringing philosophy into it. That way, he's really a traditionalist. His great love was Rashi and Yehuda Levi, and he thought the Rambam was very dangerous. He thought the Rambam basically encouraged heresy. But his other object of hate, you can call it, was Kabbalah. Although he himself in his youth had been interested in Kabbalah, and his father was a Mekubal, he came to see it as a violation of God's oneness, as a form of idolatry, and he wrote a book, Vikuach HaChachmat HaKabbalah, against Kabbalah, and this occasioned a few responses. One of them is by Ben Amozig. You see it here. It's in the heading there. I can't take my finger off the talk button to use the pointer, but it says it's Mishpatim Yudaver Al Sefer HaVikuach HaChokmat HaVavara V'Chacham HaChoker. You know, he refers to Lotzato in positive terms, but the book is a strong attack on his contemporary Shadal sense of Kabbalah. Tam Shad comes, if you recall, from in Bamidbar, Perek 11, Yud Aleph, the taste of the man. It would taste, I checked today, the English translation translates it as, it tastes like coriander seed. That is, but the Shadal, Lotzato calls himself Shadal, so here he calls it Lamed Shin Dalet. And he responds to Shadal, both Shadal's criticisms of the Zohar and Kabbalah in general. In our classes in Shadal, we'll look very carefully at what Shadal had to say. And Amoziv also wrote another book. There was another great opponent in Italy against Kabbalah, and that was Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Leon de Modena. And he wrote a book, Arino Haim. And there are two volumes of Ben Amoziv's Eimat Mafkia against it. Both of them are available also on hebrewbooks.org. You can order them. Very interesting books, Defenses of Kabbalah. In fact, right at the beginning of this book, Eimat Mafkia, he... Is there sound now?
Yes. Yeah, there is.
Sound now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We have to work on this sound. I went back to, at the beginning of the book of, he laments how intellectuals have turned on Kabbalah. People like Shadal. When they should be the ones showing the world the profundity of Kabbalah. He talks on the one hand, he says how Torah scholars, many of them, don't value secular studies. He's not referring to the Italians, he's referring to others. And then on page 5b, he writes that real Mekubalim and know what had to value secular studies. He says that Kabbalah drives people to enlarge their minds with other wisdom. Zekhal gadol b'chachmat halohut. He says, Chachmat ha-Kabbalah tavi lirdof achar ha-chachamot l'harbot yidiyatenu b'chol davar kfi asher tasig yadenu. To be a real Mekubal, to understand Kabbalah, you want to be like the Roman author Terence. Nothing is foreign to you. You want to expand your mind with everything. And you find this trait among many Mekubalim. And then he says something great. I think it's great because it really pulls the wool out from under Shadal and others. Yaakov Emden, they're all trying to show how the Zohar is a late work. And there's no question that the Zohar is a medieval work. Could have ideas that go back. But there's no question it's a medieval work. There's all sorts of... It mentions the word synagogue in it. Yisrael Tashma has a book describing the halachot in it. It mentions Simchas Torah in the Zohar. Simchas Torah is a Gaonic festival. It never existed before. It mentions in the Kudot, the vowels. The vowels were put in by the Tiberian scholars. The fact that today, this is taken in the modern Orthodox world, in the academic Orthodox world, forget about the regular world, as a muskal rishon, it's an obvious thing. And for the people who want to be the true believers, they have to say, well, this is a later interpolation. That's a later interpolation. The Chasam Sofer says, explicitly, he says, that if you took everything that's an interpolation and took it away, and he thought it was written by the Rashbi, he said you'd be left with a very, very small book, because the overwhelming majority, unquestionably, is a medieval work. What does he say to Shadal? He says he believes that the Zohar goes back to Rashbi. But the interpolations, obviously, those you have to discount. I don't know how, he wouldn't say that it's the majority. He would say they're significant interpolations. Today, scholars have done so much work that they see almost all of it. They can identify as interpolations. But he says that, Shadal, even if you can convince me, the Zohar is a forgery. This has nothing to do with Kabbalah. Kabbalah is basic to Judaism. The Zohar is simply one Kabbalistic text, a very important text, but we have other texts. We have the Bahir. We have numerous other works. Kabbalah is the ancient Jewish wisdom. If you're going to show me that the Zohar is a forgery, even though he says, I don't accept that, but if you prove it to be fine, I'll accept it. The Zohar is a forgery. But he says, this is a quote, basically. I think this is a word for a quote. What does the Zohar have to do with Kabbalah? The Zohar is simply one text. So we won't study Zohar then. Or we'll study Zohar, but we won't see it as attributed to Rashbi. But the Zohar itself is the ancient Jewish wisdom. And whether the Zohar is medieval or ancient, that's a literary question. That's a historical question. That has nothing to do with Kabbalah per se. And therefore, at least to his satisfaction, and I think there's a lot of truth. This, he really pulls the rug out from underneath. There is an ancient Jewish mysticism. You look in the Talmud, you see there's a mysticism. They're not referring to philosophy when they speak of Masa Merkava. With all due respect to the Rambam, they're not referring to physics, they're not referring to metaphysics. They're referring to some sort of ancient Jewish mystical teaching. And if the Zohar is ancient or not, that's really neither here nor there. It's the Kabbalah itself, which is what's significant, he says. And the doctrines of Kabbalah stand apart from the Zohar. And not only that, he says that there are texts in the Talmud that can only be explained through passages in Kabbalah, through ideas in Kabbalah. In Emet Mafkia, Volume 2, second page, he's speaking about Gilgal. Gilgal is something that rational Jews don't accept reincarnation. Sadi Gaon refers to people who call themselves Jews who believe in Gilgal. Even the Rashash has a note, Rashomo Strashen, against Gilgal. And yet other religions have it. The Eastern religions have it. He cites Josephus. Before he gets to Talmudic passages, which he thinks advocate Gilgal reincarnation, he cites Josephus as advocating reincarnation. And if Josephus advocates reincarnation, then obviously this is an ancient Jewish doctrine. So, I mean, you can't say this is some sort of new thing that was invented by the medieval Kabbalists who were influenced by Eastern ideas. Josephus is reflecting Pharisaic belief when he speaks of reincarnation. Let me say, however, and we'll end with this, when we meet next time, we'll begin with his Talmudic passages that deal with, that can be explained through Kabbalah, and then we'll get into his ideas about the non-Jewish world and other things. Since I mentioned Josephus, I just need to clarify that although this is true, what Ben Mozick said, and when he said it, probably was the accepted truth, and if you're online, you'll find numerous texts that do speak of Josephus and his advocacy of reincarnation. I mean, this is what he says in Wars of the Jews. He says, the Pharisees believe, quote, the souls of good men are removed into other bodies. The souls of bad men are subject to eternal punishment. So everyone assumes, and after they die, are moved into other bodies. That's reincarnation. And it might be. Indeed, it might be. However, in recent years, scholars have not read this passage this way, and Louis Feldman of Yeshiva University thinks that there is no question that in this passage, Josephus is referring to resurrection, not reincarnation. Souls of good men are removed into other bodies. That is, that the soul is reincarnated. What does it mean, into other bodies? Apparently, the idea being that God creates a new body for you. Your body has been disintegrated. So therefore, a new body is created. That's what it means by other bodies. You obviously can't be given the same body, but it's not that you're reincarnated into a new person to live a new life. It is you in a new body, and this, according to Feldman and others, is the classic doctrine of reincarnation. On the other hand, for a long time, it was that Gilgul. Yeah, reincarnation, not resurrection. Sorry, when I said that, Louis Feldman thinks it's referring to resurrection. At the end, that you'll be rise from the dead, and when it says the souls of are removed in other bodies, that means you are given a new body. So whether it's Josephus is referring to reincarnation or resurrection, I don't know if it can be determined definitively, but at least from Ben Amos' perception, here's an example that Josephus knew. Basic Kabbalistic idea, the notion of reincarnation. Pick up here next class. We meet next week. We'll probably have one more class, maybe one and a half, on Ben Amozig, and we will deal with the whole theology of Noachidism. Ben Amozig is the founder of the theology of Noachidism. He has the Talmud, a student, Palier, who is the first Noachide. Chabad made if he likes to take credit for it, there's a whole theory. Theology here. And we'll conclude with Ben Amozig, and we will also speak about the great halachic dispute that he was involved in about cremation. A dispute that was so widespread that the chief rabbi of Rome had his body cremated and buried in the Rome cemetery. You can go visit it today. So we will talk about that and lots of other good things next week. So let me answer some questions. Okay, we will thank you, Mel, for letting us know this. Tech support is going to look into this. Sometimes these problems only happen to one computer, not another. 95% of the time, everything goes okay. Tonight, we had a few problems. In fact, I wasn't able to reach for lots of books because my finger, for an hour, has been on the button. I'm not sure. Yes, a very different view from Rabbi Avad Yosef, which in a sense is a classical view that the non-Jews, their role is to basically serve the Jews. Everything is for the Jews. He has a very different role, and I will get into it. This book, Israel and Humanity, is really an incredible book. It gives us his take on the role of Jews and non-Jews. This book has not been translated to Hebrew. It has been translated to Hebrew, but in recent years, a few other books have translated to Hebrew. We will see a very, very different vision. Shoma, you say it makes sense that it's resurrection because reincarnation is also by evil souls. Why do you assume reincarnation is by evil souls? You're talking about a standard doctrine, you know, maybe you have a doctrine that reincarnation is simply are punished in hell. I mean, Olam Haba is the place where people are after the resurrection. So, but why should the evil ones be resurrected? They don't get Olam Haba. Olam Haba is where resurrected souls are joined to bodies and they live a good life, asking God's brilliance and eat the Leviathan and all these other things. What place is there for the wicked ones? The wicked ones are not to be resurrected. Of course, living in Italy. Sfarno was a Sfarno, and Shaddal was Shaddal, and the Ramchal was Ramchal, but Rashi was Rashi because he grew up in the closed environment he was, and the Rambam was the Rambam because he grew up in Spain and in enlightened Egypt. All these people are who they are because of the environment they grew up in, which enables them to expand into secular learning or not. Not every one of us. Right now, if we went to, sometimes you're able to break upbringing. Question about it. And No, I'm not posting anywhere. I have a 5-part post that's been waiting to go. The problem is that Google Books, Google does no longer allow it. You know about Google, there's Google Documents. You could edit the post before it went on. You could actually see the post the way it looks. The problem was that I have lots of pictures and links, and I first began posting when it appeared on the screen, it would be all screwed up, and by the time I was able to contact the guy who runs it and fix it, everyone's read it. So I decided I'm not going to post unless I can see everything ahead of time and fix all the mistakes. And that worked for a couple of years, but now you can't do that, although they've just figured out a way to do that with another system. So therefore, I have 5 posts waiting to go, and I don't want to let them put it on until I can actually see. There were pick times they did it there. The pictures didn't show up properly or they were in the wrong place. The next post is going to be, hopefully, I wanted to have it before this class to advertise the various Torah in Motion things, but the next post is going to be on Rav Kook. Ideas in Rav Kook's recently published writings, and I quote Ben Amozig, and a lot of good stuff coming, so stay tuned. Have any, let's see, wait one more minute if we have more questions. How did the Rambam promote apikorsis? Because the Rambam is, well, in numerous ways. First of all, the Rambam, I made it more light, by the way, so I could see better. I like bouncing off my head. He thought the Rambam promoted apikorsis because for the Rambam, in order to really reach your potential, you have to study philosophy. And philosophy means Aristotle. And Chazal said that you study that, it leads to heresy. And the Rambam says, if you look in Hilchos Deos even, he says in the Mishnah Torah that you know what Abraham taught his son? He taught his son the golden mean. You know, the Aristotelian golden mean. And Chazal says, this is outrageous. Abraham wasn't teaching his son the golden mean. He was teaching his son about how to be a good Jew. He says that the Rambam creates a God where you can't say anything about it. The God has no emotions. You can only say what God isn't. He says, if you're going to tell people God is some sort of mathematical formula, who wants that God? So, in the Rambam, the Chagall isn't the only one to say this about the Rambam, but he, Rambam, the resurrection. He says the Rambam doesn't believe in resurrection. And resurrection is a basic Jewish idea. He says the Rambam doesn't believe in individual immortality. It's all this intellectual, the intellect lives on. He says that everything the Rambam does is against traditional ideas. He says even codification is bad. He says writing the Mishnah Torah is a terrible thing. Because, by the way, everything he says, the attacks on the philosophy, you can find people who support him. The attacks on the codification, you find people who think the same thing. What does codification do? It prevents the local posek from being able to, on his own, have originality. Many of you know what the Yamshal Shlomo or Shlomo Roya said about Beis Yosef. So Chagall is extremely conservative with a small c and traditional on all these matters. And yet when it comes to Kabbalah, then I guess you could say he's radical, but he doesn't see himself as radical. He sees himself as continuing the old tradition. And he sees Kabbalah as a newfangled tradition which is coming in to destroy, just like the Rambam destroyed belief in God because God becomes a philosophical God. So too, Kabbalah destroys belief in God because now belief in God is a belief in Sfirot and all these sorts of things. And he says, I am believing in the God of Yehuda Levi, the God of Rashi, and the God of the rabbis of the Talmud. So that's why Chagall is so interesting. And we'll definitely do classes on Chagall. I don't know. The Rambam's views are not normative, not at all. As I point out in Limits of Orthodox Theology, the great irony, one of the great irony of Jewish history, is that the Rambam's views, the Rambam's 13 principles are accepted at the same time that the Rambam's views, his larger philosophical views, in fact, the views that are the philosophical underpinnings of the 13 principles, are entirely rejected. Is there anyone who in your community who believes that you and me and basically everyone who walks down the street is subject to the chance, the vagaries of chance? According to the Rambam, there's no divine providence on any of us, unless we're super intellectuals. That's not a traditional Jewish belief, certainly today. Does the Rambam think that, do people in your area think that the only way to get immortality is through intellectual attainments? That's not normative at all. The only thing that's normative is his notions of, I guess, as is in the bastardized versions of his philosophy in the 13 principles, which are really not his ideas per se. They're his ideas altered. It's not normative. I don't know if that's... I don't think you grow up hearing them. You grow up hearing certain things. For example, Rambam, maybe the idea that God doesn't have a body. But did you really grow up hearing what I just said, that that providence is entirely dependent on intellect? That angels are not beings? Angels are... Rambam doesn't think that you have angels come down to speak to you. And, all the ideas of the Rambam, the most basic idea, which is in the Mishnah Torah itself, that the only way to understand God is through philosophy. You have big things and small things. And the small things we need to study are Talmud, and the big things, that is in relation to Talmud, is philosophy. I don't think any of the yeshivas in Passaic have required courses on medieval philosophy, and not only that, astronomy and chemistry, all these things you need to study. Again, I don't have to thank you, Kami. But Archerol doesn't make a normative. It's the Rambam of the Mishnah Torah. And only some volumes of the Mishnah Torah, not Sefer Mada. That's what became normative as a halachic text. But his philosophy, and let's not forget, the dispute over the Rambam's writings broke out about the Mishnah Torah, not about the Mora, about the volume one, the Sefer Mada. In fact, the argument has been made, and in one of the Svarim blogs coming up, I discuss it, that the Mishnah Torah is more radical than the Guide for the Perplexed. Just to give you one example. The Guide for the Perplexed says that you must, after you must believe, the Guide for the Perplexed says that God created the world from nothing. He never says God created the world. He never uses the word Borei. He doesn't say that. There are certain areas where the Mishnah Torah is actually more radical than the Guide for the Perplexed. I'm waiting for Art Scroll. You know, they're doing all these things. Now they're doing the Midrash Rabbah. It's supposed to be a 15 or 16 volume set. See, the thing about Art Scroll is as follows. They have this foundation. You have lots of people making Parnassa. They finish with the Talmud. They finish basically with Tanakh. But they have the money still, so they keep going. So what else to do? So now they're doing to Hebrew the Talmud, they're doing to French, and they're doing Yerushalmi. But they're good. They keep going. This is going to go on forever, as long as people give money. So now they're moving on to Midrash Rabbah. They are translating also all sorts of obscure texts. The Mishnah Torah, which is the most important text for the last 1,000 years in terms of Jewish law, has not been translated. I guess that in the Shulchan Aruch. Why haven't they translated Shulchan Aruch? I have no idea. Why haven't they translated the Mishnah Torah? Again, I don't know. I assume they'll come to it eventually. How they will deal with the Sefer Mada, I don't know. Already Rishonim argued that the Rambam is valuable to us because of his halachic writings, not because of his philosophical writings. And Menachem Kellner, in his book, on Maimonides and Mysticism, makes the case that the Rambam lost his battle to Jewish mysticism, that our society is, from a halachic standpoint, the Rambam is very significant, but philosophically, we have rejected the Rambam, and Jewish mysticism really is running the show. So when you hear Yisrael about the Rambam's name every 10 seconds, pay attention to what you hear it about. You're hearing it about ideas, comments on the Parsha, but not comments like on last week's Parsha, that everything was in a dream. That the Rambam says it's forbidden to listen to. You'll hear basic ideas about the Rambam, the more popular ideas in the Guide. You'll hear things in the Mishnah Torah. But you're not going to hear his philosophical ideas. Someone points out that if they do the Rambam, maybe they'll have to censor some of him. Hard to say. Maybe that's why they don't do the Rambam, because you can censor Rav Zevin and others, but it's hard to censor the Rambam. So what I would say to you, Yisrael, and just end with this, is that the Rambam is obviously the most important, and he does dominate, but certain aspects of his philosophy are ignored, and that's the way it should be, according to me. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky even says that when it comes to the Rambam science, and I assume that includes his philosophy also, because the philosophy is based on the science, that we don't accept. It's in his Emes LeYaakov. there's nothing new. It's been hundreds and hundreds of years now that the Rambam has been bifurcated. But aren't there other figures we do the same thing with? Take what we like, and we don't take what we don't like. Same thing with the Rambam. Ah, okay, one more comment before we go. Rabbi Soloveitchik, someone, a very learned person online, points out Rabbi Soloveitchik. Think for a minute, Yisrael, how often the Rav is quoted. It's quoted constantly. And yet what's quoted? Lots of good stuff is quoted, but there are certain things that aren't quoted so much. According to Rabbi Soloveitchik, Jews should be involved with Christians in matters affecting our mutual concern. Local rabbi and the local priest should get together if there's issues that are going to hurt religion as a whole, matters of the environment. And he says this explicitly in that famous footnote in Confrontation. And yet, I haven't seen the RCA recently. I haven't seen other rabbis talk about how this is valuable. Not even a mention there about the Rav's famous position expressed before at one RCA convention. There was like 1,000 people there, and expressed on numerous occasions that you can even give up the Western Wall if it would bring peace. And that giving up land is a requirement if it's going to bring up peace. And yet Rav Schechter has a whole chapter on the land of Israel and doesn't mention this at all. And lots of other students of Rabbi Soloveitchik don't mention this. Emmanuel Jacobovitz, he has conversations with Michael Shashar. Very interesting book. A lot of discussions on all sorts of matters. And his brother-in-law, Jacobovitz's brother-in-law, is Fabian Schoenfeld. Well-known rabbi in New York for many years, very much on the right wing of the Republican National Convention. And I told this, the only time I ever was with Rabbi Soloveitchik was that summer, and I used to drive him back and forth to the class, the COLA. This is the last year of the COLA, and I remember I told Rabbi Soloveitchik about this, and he was very impressed. You know, he said that when he came to America, every time a politician would come to town, the Reform rabbis would have to go out and speak for him because the Orthodox rabbis didn't speak English, and he knew Schoenfeld very well. Schoenfeld is a Talmud Lubavitch for many years. So Jacobovitz records how he asked his brother-in-law, Schoenfeld, why is it that such a big Talmud of the Rav, always quoting the Rav. In fact, even on the movie about these matters, I have a different Rebbe. My Rebbe in those matters was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So even a Talmud Mufak like Schoenfeld doesn't have to follow his Rebbe, and the Rav would agree with this, because the Rav didn't want to have Hasidim. He only wanted you to follow him if you thought he was correct. But my point is, how many people are quoting the Rav on these matters? Certain things of the Rav are very passe, very, you have a Rosh Hashiva, why you, Rabbi Rechman, went so far as to give an interview to the YU student newspaper last year saying that the Rav was speaking in a different era. Today, we don't need this kind of stuff. The Rav's vision is just like what they did with Hirsch. So it's all the same. So we have Bill Gort saying it, but he said it privately also. The Tshuva Drasha could have had 1,000 people there. Be nice. By the way, Bill, next week I'm going to talk about... The Rav's point about if it's stupid, it's forbidden, because Shlomo, who's listening, pointed out to me a text dealing with that, so we will get to it. And I'm even going to show you that this has Chabad antecedents, I think. Going back to the Alter Rebbe, they have this tradition that if it's stupid, it's forbidden. I'm going to speculate, perhaps, that this is one of the things that the Rav got from his Chabad backgrounds. So hold it, hang out there, hang in for next week. Look on the website very soon. We'll send out links to it about the wonderful trip, and I will return to that. Yes, no, but he said it another time in Shir. That's what I'm referring to. Okay, everyone, good night, and I'll see you next week, God willing. And we'll try to work on this technical problem. Thank you, everyone.